Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram time.
It's 6 o'clock.
Pickup Country gets around, and we have the post to prove it. Like WSKV-FM on Facebook and let us know where you're listening from.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV for our new and exciting Pick Me a Story series, where you'll embark on a journey through the pages of different stories read aloud by featured librarians from the Powell County Public Library. You can tune in live right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, listen online or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with our free mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcast. My name is Kelly Ward, and I am the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library. I'll be reading all kinds of different books to you from different genres, like sci-fi and fantasy, westerns, mysteries, and more. Be healthy at home with the whole family and enjoy the storytelling service provided by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and the Powell County Public Library. Pick Me a Story will be every Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on your hometown station, and we're so excited you can join us tonight. Let's get started. For tonight's show, we'll be finishing up Isaac Asimov's science fiction short story, Lenny, a story about a robot made horribly wrong, with the personality of a human baby. When we wrap that story up, we'll switch genres and head into one of my favorite genres, horror. We'll be reading the classic psychological horror story, The Yellow Wallpaper, by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is a Southern Gothic horror story about a woman locked in a yellow wallpapered room, and the insanity that ensues. When we're done with that story, we'll dive into the classic short story, The Tell-Tale Heart, by Edgar Allan Poe, followed by more. Now, let's pick up where we left off last week with Lenny by Isaac Asimov. I hope you enjoy it. Dr. Susan Calvin was U.S. Robots, and virtually mankind's, only robo-psychologist. She did not have to go very far in her testing of LNE prototype before she called very peremptorily for a transcript of the computer-drawn plans of the positronic brain paths and the taped instructions that had directed them. After some study, she, in turn, sent for Bogart. Her iron gray hair was drawn severely back. Her cold face, with its strong vertical lines marked off by the horizontal gash of the pale, thin-lipped mouth, turned intensely upon him. "What is this, Peter?" Bogart studied the passages she pointed out with increasing stupefaction and said, "Good Lord, Susan, it makes no sense." "It most certainly doesn't. How did it get into the instructions?" The technician in charge, called upon, swore in all sincerity that it was none of his doing, and that he could not account for it. The computer checked out negative for all attempts at flaw finding. "The positronic brain," said Susan Calvin, thoughtfully, "is past redemption. So many of the higher functions have been canceled out by these meaningless directions that the result is very like a human baby." Bogart looked surprised, and Susan Calvin took on a frozen attitude at once, as she always did at the least expressed or implied doubt of her word. She said, "We make every effort to make a robot as mentally like a man as possible. Eliminate what we call the adult functions, and what is naturally left is a human infant, mentally speaking. Why do you look so surprised, Peter?" LNE prototype, who showed no signs of understanding any of the things that were going on around it, suddenly slipped into a sitting position and began a minute examination of its feet. Bogart stared at it. "It's a shame to have to dismantle the creature. It's a handsome job." "Dismantle it?" said the robo-psychologist forcefully. "Of course, Susan. What's the use of this thing? Good Lord, if there's one object completely and abysmally useless, it's a robot without a job it can perform. You don't pretend there's a job this thing can do, do you?"
"No, of course not."
"Well, then?"
Susan Calvin said stubbornly, "I want to conduct more tests."
Bogart looked at her with a moment's impatience, then shrugged. If there was one person at U.S. Robots with whom it was useless to dispute, surely that was Susan Calvin. Robots were all she loved,
and long association with them, it seemed to Bogert, had deprived her of any appearance of humanity. She was no more to be argued out of a decision than was a triggered micropile to be argued out of operating. "What's the use?" he breathed, then aloud, hastily, "Will you let us know when your tests are complete?" "I will," she said. "Come, Lenny." L-N-E, thought Bogert. That becomes Lenny. Inevitable. Susan Calvin held out her hand, but the robot only stared at it. Gently, the robopsychologist reached for the robot's hand and took it. Lenny rose smoothly to its feet. Its mechanical coordination, at least, worked well. Together, they walked out, robot topping woman by 2 feet. Many eyes followed them curiously down the long corridors. One wall of Susan Calvin's laboratory, the one opening directly off her private office, was covered with a highly magnified reproduction of a positronic path chart. Susan Calvin had studied it with absorption for the better part of a month. She was considering it now, carefully, tracing the blunted paths through their contortions. Behind her, Lenny sat on the floor, moving its legs apart and together, crooning meaningless syllables to itself in a voice so beautiful that one could listen to the nonsense and be ravished. Susan Calvin turned to the robot. "Lenny! Lenny!" She repeated this patiently, until finally Lenny looked up and made an inquiring sound. The robopsychologist allowed a glimmer of pleasure to cross her face fleetingly. The robot's attention was being gained in progressively shorter intervals. She said, "Raise your hand, Lenny. Hand up. Hand up." She raised her own hand as she said it, over and over. Lenny followed the movement with its eyes. Up, down, up, down. Then it made an abortive gesture with its own hand and chimed, "Very good, Lenny," said Susan Calvin gravely. "Try it again. Hand up." Very gently, she reached out her own hand, took the robot's, and raised it, lowered it. Hand up. Hand up. A voice from her office called and interrupted. "Susan?" Calvin halted with a tightening of her lips. "What is it, Alfred?" The research director walked in and looked at the chart on the wall and at the robot. "Still at it?" "I'm at my work, yes." "Well, you know, Susan." He took out a cigar, staring at it hard, and made as though to bite off the end. In doing so, his eyes met the woman's stern look of disapproval, and he put the cigar away and began over. "Well, you know, Susan, the L&E model is in production now." "So I've heard. Is there something in connection with it you wish of me?" No. Still, the mere fact that it is in production and is doing well means that working with this messed up specimen is useless. Shouldn't it be scrapped?" "In short, Alfred, you are annoyed that I am wasting my so valuable time. Feel relieved. My time is not being wasted. I am working with this robot." "But the work has no meaning." "I'll be the judge of that, Alfred." Her voice was ominously quiet, and Lanning thought it wiser to shift his ground. Will you tell me what meaning it has? What are you doing with it right now, for instance?" "I'm trying to get it to raise its hand on the word of command. I'm trying to get it to imitate the sound of the word." As though on cue, Lenny said, and raised its hand waveringly. Lanning shook his head. "That voice is amazing. How does it happen?" Susan Calvin said, "I don't quite know. Its transmitter is a normal one. It could speak normally, I'm sure. It doesn't, however. It speaks like this as a consequence of something in the positronic path that I have not yet pinpointed." "Well, pinpoint it, for heaven's sake. Speech like that might be useful." "Oh, then there is some possible use in my studies on Lenny?" Lanning shrugged in embarrassment. "Oh well, it's a minor point." "I'm sorry you don't see the major points, then," said Susan Calvin with asperity, "which are much more important, but that's not my fault. Would you leave now, Alfred, and let me go on with my work? Lanning got to his cigar, eventually, in Bogart's office. He said sourly, "That woman is growing more peculiar daily." Bogart understood perfectly. In the U.S. Robots and Mechanical Men Corporation, there was only one "that woman." He said, "Is she still scuffing about with that pseudo-robot, that Lenny of hers?" "Trying to get it to talk, so help me." Bogart shrugged. "Points up the company problem. I mean, about getting qualified personnel for research. If we had other robo-psychologists, we could retire Susan. Incidentally, I presume the director's meeting scheduled for tomorrow is for the purpose of dealing with the procurement problem." Lanning nodded and looked at his cigar as though it didn't taste good. "Yes. Quality, though, not quantity. We've raised wages until there's a steady stream of applicants. Those who are interested primarily in money. The trick is to get those who are interested primarily in robotics. A few more, like Susan Calvin." No, not like her. Well, not like her, personally. But you'll have to admit, Peter, that she's single-minded about robots. She has no other interest in life. I know, and that's exactly what makes her so unbearable. Lanning nodded. He had lost count of the many times it would have done his soul good to have fired Susan Calvin. He had also lost count of the number of millions of dollars she had at one time or another saved the company. She was a truly indispensable woman, and would remain one until she died. Or until they could lick the problem of finding men and women of her own high caliber, who were interested in robotics research. He said, "I think we'll cut down on the tour business." Peter shrugged. "If you say so. But meanwhile, seriously, what do we do about Susan? She can easily tie herself up with Lenny indefinitely. You know how she is when she gets one she considers an interesting problem." "What can we do?" said Lanning. "If we become too anxious to pull her off, she'll stay on out of feminine contrariness. In the last analysis, we can't force her to do anything." The dark-haired mathematician smiled. "I wouldn't ever apply the adjective feminine to any part of her." "Oh, well," said Lanning, grumpily. "At least it won't do anyone any actual harm." And that, if in nothing else, he was wrong. The emergency signal is always a tension-making thing in any large industrial establishment. Such signals had sounded in the history of U.S. robots a dozen times, for fire, flood, riot, and insurrection. But one thing had never occurred in all that time. Never had the particular signal indicating "robot out of control" sounded. No one ever expected it to sound. It was only installed at government insistence. "Darn the Frankenstein complex," Lanning would mutter on those rare occasions when he thought of it. Now, finally, the shrill siren rose and fell at 10-second intervals, and practically no worker from the president of the board of directors down to the newest janitor's assistant recognized the significance of the strange sound for a few moments. After those moments passed, there was a massive convergence of armed guards and medical men to the indicated area of danger, and U.S. Robots was struck with paralysis. Charles Randall, computing technician, was taken off to the hospital level with a broken arm. There was no other damage, no other physical damage. "But the moral damage," roared Lanning, "is beyond estimation." Susan Calvin faced him, murderously calm. "You will do nothing to Lenny. Nothing. Do you understand?" "Do you understand, Susan? That thing has hurt a human being. It has broken the first law. Don't you know what first law is?" "You will do nothing to Lenny." "For God's sake, Susan, do I have to tell you first law? A robot may not harm a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Our entire position depends on the fact that first law is rigidly observed by all robots of all types. If the public should hear, and they will hear, that there was an exception, even one exception, we might be forced to close down altogether. Our only chance of survival would be to announce at once that the robot involved had been destroyed, explain the circumstances, and hope that the public can be convinced that it will never happen again. I would like to find out exactly what happened, said Susan Calvin. I was not present at the time, and I would like to know exactly what the Randall boy was doing in my laboratories without my permission. The important thing that happened, said Lanning, is obvious. Your robot struck Randall and the fool flashed the robot out of control button and made a case of it. But your robot struck him and inflicted damage to the extent of a broken arm. The truth is, your Lenny is so distorted, it lacks first law, and it must be destroyed. It does not lack first law. I have studied its brain paths and know it does not lack it. Then how could it strike a man? Desperation turned him to sarcasm. Ask Lenny. Surely you have taught it to speak by now. Susan Kelvin's cheeks flushed a painful pink. She said, I prefer to interview the victim. And in my absence, Alfred, I want my offices sealed tight, with Lenny inside. I want no one to approach him. If any harm comes to him while I am gone, this company will not see me again under any circumstances. Will you agree to its destruction if it has broken first law? Yes, said Susan Calvin, because I know it hasn't. And we'll be back with more after this.
Serving East Central Kentucky, tell Pickup Country 104.9 what's coming up in your community or church at WSKVFM.com under Community. WSKV FM, Faith, Family, Community.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Anna Klein.
And John Looney.
We're Grits and Soul. The Kentucky Department of Health and Family Services advises all working people to work from home and all students in schools to use distance learning options.
We encourage you to stay at home if you're sick or show any symptoms that could possibly spread to others.
Please stay well and stay healthy at home.
This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Charles Randall lay in bed with his arms set and in a cast. His major suffering was still from the shock of those few moments in which he thought a robot was advancing on him with murder in its positronic mind. No other human had ever had such reason to fear direct robotic harm as he had had just then. He had had a unique experience. Susan Calvin and Alfred Lanning stood beside his bed now. Peter Bogert, who had met them on the way, was with them. Doctors and nurses had been shooed out. Susan Calvin said, Now, what happened? Randall was daunted. He muttered, The thing hit me in the arm. It was coming at me. Calvin said, Move further back in the story. What were you doing in my laboratory without authorization? The young computer swallowed. And the Adam's apple in his thin neck bobbed noticeably. He was high cheekboned and abnormally pale. He said, We all knew about your robot. The word is you were trying to teach it to talk like a musical instrument. There were bets going as to whether it talked or not. Some said, you could teach a gatepost to talk. I suppose, said Susan Calvin, freezingly. That is meant as a compliment. What did that have to do with you? I was supposed to go in there and settle matters, see if it would talk. You know, we swiped a key to your place, and I waited till you were gone and went in. We had a lottery on who was to do it. I lost. Then? I tried to get it to talk, and it hit me. What do you mean, you tried to get it to talk? How did you try? I asked it questions, but it wouldn't say anything, and I had to give the thing a fair shake, so I kind of yelled at it, and... And? There was a long pause. Under Susan Calvin's unwavering stare, Randall finally said, I tried to scare it into saying something, he added defensively. I had to give the thing a fair shake. How did you try to scare it? I pretended to take a punch at it? And it brushed your arm aside? It hit my arm. Very well, that's all. To Lanning and Bogart, she said, Come, gentlemen. At the doorway, she turned back to Randall. I can settle the bets going around if you are still interested. Lenny can speak a few words quite well. They said nothing until they were in Susan Calvin's office. Its walls were lined with her books, some of which she had written herself. It retained the patina of her own frigid, carefully ordered personality. It had only one chair in it, and she sat down. Lanning and Bogart remained standing. She said, Lenny only defended itself. That is the third law. A robot must protect its own existence. Except, said Lanning forcefully, when this conflicts with the first or second laws, complete the statement. Lenny had no right to defend itself in any way at the cost of harm, however minor, to a human being. Nor did it, shot back Calvin, knowingly. Lenny has an aborted brain. It had no way of knowing its own strength or the weakness of humans. In brushing aside the threatening arm of a human being, it could not know the bone would break. In human terms, no moral blame can be attached to an individual who honestly cannot differentiate good and evil. Bogart interrupted soothingly. Now, Susan, we don't blame. We understand that Lenny is the equivalent of a baby, humanly speaking, and we don't blame it. But the public will. U.S. robots will be closed down. Quite the opposite. If you had the brains of a flea, Peter, you would see that this is the opportunity U.S. robots is waiting for. That this will solve its problems. Lanning hunched his white eyebrows low. He said softly, What problem, Susan? Isn't the corporation concerned about maintaining our research personnel at the present? Heaven help us. High level? We certainly are. Well, what are you offering prospective researchers? Excitement? Novelty? The thrill of piercing the unknown? No, you offer them salaries and the assurance of no problems. Bogart said, How do you mean, no problems? Are there problems? Shot back Susan Calvin. What kind of robots do we turn out? Fully developed robots, fit for their tasks. An industry tells us what it needs. A computer designs the brain. Machinery forms the robot. And there it is, complete and done. Peter, some time ago, you asked me with reference to Lenny what its use was. What's the use, you said, of a robot that was not designed for any job? Now I ask you, what's the use of a robot designed for only one job? It begins and ends in the same place. The LNE models, mine boron. If beryllium is needed, they are useless. If boron technology enters a new phase, they become useless. A human being so designed would be subhuman. A robot so designed is sub-robotic. Do you want a versatile robot? Asked Lanning, incredulously. Why not? Demanded the robo-psychologist. Why not? I've been handed a robot with a brain almost completely stultified. I've been teaching it, and you, Alfred, asked me what was the use of that. Perhaps very little as far as Lenny itself is concerned, since it will never progress beyond the 5-year-old level on a human scale. But what's the use in general? A very great deal, if you consider it as a study in the abstract problem of learning how to teach robots. I have learned ways to short-circuit neighboring pathways in order to create new ones. More study will yield better, more subtle, and more efficient techniques of doing so. Well? Suppose you started with a positronic brain that had all the basic pathways carefully outlined, but none of the secondaries. Suppose you then started creating secondaries. You could sell basic robots designed for instruction. robots that could be modeled to a job and then modeled to another if necessary. Robots would become as versatile as human beings. Robots could learn. They stared at her. She said, impatiently, "You still don't understand, do you?"
"I understand what you were saying," said Lanning.
"Don't you understand that with a completely new field of research and completely new techniques to be developed, with a completely new area of the unknown to be penetrated, youngsters will feel a new urge to enter robotics? Try it and see." "May I point out," said Bogart, smoothly, "that this is dangerous. Beginning with ignorant robots, such as Lenny, will mean that one can never trust First Law, exactly as turned out in Lenny's case."
"Exactly. Advertise the fact."
"Advertise it?"
"Of course. Broadcast the danger. Explain that you will set up a new research institute on the moon, if Earth's population chooses not to allow this sort of thing to go on upon Earth. But stress the danger to the possible applicants, by all means."
Lanning said, "For God's sake, why?"
"Because the spice of danger will add to the lure. Do you think nuclear technology involves no danger and spacionautics no peril? Has your lure of absolute security been doing the trick for you? Has it helped you to cater to the Frankenstein complex you all despise so? Try something else, then, something that has worked in other fields."
There was a sound from beyond the door that led to Calvin's personal laboratories. It was the chiming sound of Lenny. The robopsychologist broke off instantly, listening. She said, "Excuse me, I think Lenny is calling me."
"Can it call you?" said Lanning.
"I said I've managed to teach it a few words." She stepped toward the door, a little flustered. "If you will wait for me..." They watched her leave and were silent for a moment. Then Lanning said, "Do you think there's anything to what she says, Peter?"
"Just possibly, Alfred," said Bogart. "Just possibly. Enough for us to bring the matter up at the director's meeting and see what they say. After all, the fat is in the fire. A robot has harmed a human being, and knowledge of it is public. As Susan says, we might as well try to turn the matter to our advantage. Of course, I distrust her motives in all of this."
"How do you mean?"
Even if all she has said is perfectly true, it is only rationalization as far as she is concerned. Her motive in all this is her desire to hold on to this robot. If we pressed her," and the mathematician smiled at the incongruous literal meaning of the phrase, "she would say it was to continue learning techniques of teaching robots. But I think she has found another use for Lenny. A rather unique one that would fit only Susan, of all women."
"I don't get your drift," Bogart said. "Did you hear what the robot was calling?"
"Well, no, I didn't quite," began Lanning, when the door opened suddenly and both men stopped talking at once.
Susan Calvin stepped in again, looking about uncertainly. "Have either of you seen... I'm positive I had it somewhere about... Oh, there it is."
She ran to a corner of one bookcase and picked up an object of intricate metal webbery, dumbbell-shaped and hollow, with variously shaped metal pieces inside each hollow, just too large to be able to fall out of the webbing. As she picked it up, the metal pieces within moved and struck together, clicking pleasantly. It struck Lanning that the object was a kind of robotic version of a baby rattle. As Susan Calvin opened the door again to pass through, Lenny's voice chimed again from within. This time, Lanning heard it clearly as it spoke the words Susan Calvin had taught it. In heavenly, celeste-like sounds, it called out, "Mommy! I want you! I want you, Mommy!" And the footsteps of Susan Calvin could be heard hurrying eagerly across the laboratory floor toward the only kind of baby she could ever have or love. The end.
Pick Up Country 104.9. Preset us on your radio. We're your community station serving Powell, Estill, Montgomery, Clark, Lee, Bath, Menifee, Owsley, and Wolf counties.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library.
All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works toward its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powhatan Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powhatan Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password, PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network Bookmobile Wireless and use the same password from the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public just yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powhatan Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer. And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powhatan Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcplky.org. The staff of the Powhatan Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
There are simple things Kentuckians can do to avoid COVID-19. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Disinfect frequently touched surfaces and avoid sick people. Find the facts at kycovid19.ky.gov because we're all part of Team Kentucky.
This message brought to you by Pickup Country, 104.9 WSKV.
Before we get started with the yellow wallpaper, let's go ahead and get started with The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease has sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How, then, am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain. But once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object, there was none. Passion, there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. One of his eyes resembled that of a vulture. A pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man, and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded. With what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, closed, that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ha! Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously. Oh, so cautiously. Cautiously. For the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single, thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone, and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man, indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moved more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door, little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he had heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now, you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with a thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened, though fear of robbers. And so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on, steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still, and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. Oh, no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor." Or, "It is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions. But he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, stealthily, until, at length, a single dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct, precisely upon the spot. And now have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the senses? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet, I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker, and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet, for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once, once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up 3 planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out. No stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. Ha ha! When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered 3 men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search. Search well. I led them, at length, to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But, ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat, and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued, and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definitiveness until, at length, I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt, I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice. Yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observation of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh God, what could I do? I foamed. I raved. I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, louder, louder. And still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God. No, no, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder, 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 louder. Villains! I shrieked. Dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here. It is the beating of his hideous heart. The end.
Pickup Country 104.9, serving Winchester, Campton, Sand Hill, the Red River Gorge, Proctor, Red Lick, Richmond, Jackson, St. Helens, and Palmer. Thanks for listening local and around the world at WSKVFM.com.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store, or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Lance Rogers. You can help stop the spread of respiratory diseases like COVID-19 by washing your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or by using a hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol content. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
Pickup Country 104.9, serving Betaville, Sharpsburg, Judy, Wellington, Ford, Waco, Hazel Green, Slade, and Vincent. Thanks for listening local and around the world at WSKVFM.com.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. All checkout dates have been extended until further notice, and there will be no late fees on any account at this time. As the library works toward its reopening date, you can expect our book drop service to return soon, as well as our new innovative curbside service. For more information about these services and the innovative programs we offer, keep an eye on the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page for any and all updates. Free Wi-Fi is still offered at the Powell County Public Library, which is located by Stanton Elementary. To access this Wi-Fi from the comfort of your vehicle, just select the network Public Library Wireless and use the free Wi-Fi password, PCPLKY65. Free Wi-Fi is also provided at the stationary bookmobile, which is in its new location at Clay City Elementary. To take advantage of the bookmobile Wi-Fi, just sign on to the network, Bookmobile Wireless, and use the same password from the main library, which is PCPLKY65. Flyers containing all of this information are posted on the doors of the main library and on the bookmobile for reference. Although the library isn't open to the public just yet, you can still check out our online catalog by going to the Powell County Public Library's website at pcplky.org to see everything our digital collection has to offer,
And you can check out digital library books, audiobooks, and magazines with the free Libby or OverDrive apps in the Google Play or App Store. All you need is the barcode number on the back of your library card to have access to thousands of ebooks and digital materials. For any questions, just message the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page or send the library an email at info@pcply.org. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourages the community to continue practicing safe social distancing methods as our community opens back up so that we can all be a part of Team Kentucky.
Hey, this is Aaron Boyd. The President's Guidelines for America remind you that even if you're young or otherwise, you're at risk, and your activities can increase the risk for others. It's so important that we all do our part to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Stay safe, Kentucky. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. It is very seldom that mere ordinary people like John and myself secure ancestral halls for the summer. A colonial mansion, a hereditary estate, I would say a haunted house, and reach the height of romantic felicity, but that would be asking too much of fate. Still, I will proudly declare that there is something queer about it. Else, why should it be let so cheaply? And why have stood so long untenanted? John laughs at me, of course, but one expects that in marriage. John is practical in the extreme. He has no patience with faith, an intense horror of superstition, and he scoffs openly at any talk of things not to be felt and seen and put down in figures. John is a physician, and, perhaps, I would not say it to a living soul, of course, but this is dead paper and a great relief to my mind. Perhaps that is one reason I do not get well faster. You see, he does not believe I am sick. And what can one do? If a physician of high standing and one's own husband assures friends and relatives that there is really nothing the matter with one but temporary nervous depression, a slight hysterical tendency, what is one to do? My brother is also a physician, and also of high standing, and he says the same thing. So, I take phosphates or phosphites, whichever it is, and tonics and journeys, and air, and exercise, and am absolutely forbidden to work until I am well again. Personally, I disagree with their ideas. Personally, I believe that congenial work, with excitement and change, would do me good. But what is one to do? I did write for a while, in spite of them, but it does exhaust me a good deal, having to be so sly about it, or else meet with heavy opposition. I sometimes fancy that in my condition, if I had less opposition and more society and stimulus. But John says the very worst thing I can do is to think about my condition, and I confess it always makes me feel bad. So, I will let it alone and talk about the house. The most beautiful place. It is quite alone, standing well back from the road, quite 3 miles from the village. It makes me think of English places that you read about, for there are hedges and walls and gates that lock, and lots of separate little houses for the gardeners and people. There is a delicious garden. I never saw such a garden. Large and shady, full of box-bordered paths and lined with long grape-covered arbors with seats under them. There were greenhouses, too, but they are all broken now. There was some legal trouble, I believe, something about the heirs and co-heirs. Anyhow, the place has been empty for years. That spoils my ghostliness, I am afraid. But I don't care. There is something strange about the house. I can feel it. I even said so to John one moonlight evening, but he said what I felt was a draught and shut the window. I get unreasonably angry with John sometimes. I'm sure I never used to be so sensitive. I think it is due to this nervous condition. But John says if I feel so, I shall neglect proper self-control. So, I take pains to control myself. Before him, at least, and that makes me very tired. I don't like our room a bit. I wanted one downstairs that opened on the piazza and had roses all over the window.
and such pretty old-fashioned chintz hangings. But John would not hear of it. He said there was only one window and not room for two beds, and no near room for him if he took another. He is very careful and loving, and hardly lets me stir without special direction. I have a scheduled prescription for each hour in the day. He takes all care from me, and so I feel basely ungrateful not to value it more. He said we came here solely on my account, that I was to have perfect rest and all the air I could get. "Your exercise depends on your strength, my dear," said he, "and your food somewhat on your appetite. But air you can absorb all the time." So we took the nursery at the top of the house. It is a big, airy room, the whole floor nearly, with windows that look all ways, and air and sunshine galore. It was nursery first, and then playroom, and gymnasium, I should judge, for the windows are barred for little children, and there are rings and things in the walls. The paint and paper looks as if a boy's school had used it. It is stripped off, the paper, in great patches all around the head of my bed, about as far as I can reach, and in a great place on the other side of the room low down. I never saw a worse paper in my life. One of those sprawling, flamboyant patterns committing every artistic sin. It is dull enough to confuse the eye and following, pronounced enough to constantly irritate and provoke study. And when you follow the lame, uncertain curves for a little distance, they suddenly commit suicide, plunge off at outrageous angles, destroy themselves in unheard-of contradictions. The color is repellent, almost revolting, a smoldering, unclean yellow, strangely faded by the slow-turning sunlight. It is a dull, yet lurid orange in some places, a sickly sulfur tint in others. No wonder the children hated it. I should hate it myself if I had to live in this room long. There comes John, and I must put this away. He hates to have me write a word. We have been here 2 weeks, and I haven't felt like writing before, since that first day. I am sitting by the window now, up in this atrocious nursery, and there is nothing to hinder my writing as much as I please, save lack of strength. John is away all day, and even some nights when his cases are serious. I am glad my case is not serious. But these nervous troubles are dreadfully depressing. John does not know how much I really suffer. He knows there is no reason to suffer, and that satisfies him. Of course, it is only nervousness. It does weigh on me so not to do my duty in any way. I meant to be such a help to John, such a real rest and comfort, and here I am, a comparative burden already. Nobody would believe what an effort it is to do what little I am able, to dress and to entertain and order things. It is fortunate Mary is so good with the baby, such a dear baby. And yet I cannot be with him. It makes me so nervous. I suppose John never was nervous in his life. He laughs at me so about this wallpaper. At first, he meant to repaper the room, but afterwards he said that I was letting it get the better of me, and that nothing was worse for a nervous patient than to give way to such fancies. He said that after the wallpaper was changed, it would be the heavy bedstead, and then the barred windows, and then that gate at the head of the stairs, and so on. "You know the place is doing you good," he said, "and really, dear, I don't care to renovate the house just for a 3 months' rental." "Then do let us go downstairs," I said. "There are such pretty rooms there." Then he took me in his arms and called me a blessed little goose and said he would go down cellar, if I wished, and have it whitewashed into the bargain. But he is right enough about the beds and windows and things. It is an airy and comfortable room as anyone need wish, and, of course, I would not be so silly as to make him uncomfortable just for a whim. I'm really getting quite fond of the big room, all but that horrid paper. And with that, we'll finish the story next Thursday night.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for our Pick Me a Story series, right here on your hometown station, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV. If you missed tonight's segment, you can always listen on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store and on Apple Podcast. If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tune in next Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and join me for the next installment of Pick Me a Story. My name is Kelly Ward and I'm the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library, and it's my pleasure to share stories with the community during this time when we should all be staying healthy at home and practicing social distancing methods. If you have any recommendations for what books we should explore next, just send me an email at kward@pcplky.org. That's kward@pcplky.org. Don't forget to tune in next week on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, online at listenlikealocal.com, or with the free WSKV app for our next installment of Pick Me a Story. Be safe and have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Pickup Country 104.9, serving Mount Sterling, Frenchburg, Colby, Berea, Clay City, Barnes Mountain, Heidelberg, and Traveler's Rest. Thanks for listening local and around the world at WSKVFM.com.